Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscawen. It has been nearly 3 years since the Paris Climate Agreement was adopted by nearly 200 countries. The goal of the Paris Accord is to keep average global temperatures from warming at most 2 degrees Celsius to avoid the most catastrophic effects of climate change, with the best case scenario capping the increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Next week, representatives from those countries will meet in Katowice, Poland, to begin the hard work of producing the rules participants will try to live by. So where does the U.S. fit into the picture? President Trump famously has said he'll pull the United States out of the Paris Accord. This is 13 federal agencies have issued the most recent national climate assessment, which, among other things, warns of a critical blow to the economy if warming goes unchecked. Also, is it time to seriously consider technologies which remove carbon already in the air? Thoughts, questions, or comments? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet works at WHYY Radio Times. So first up, Katowice. Jean Chemnick is an E&E news reporter who is covering the UN Climate Conference. Hello, Jean.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So arguably, Jean, some of the hardest work of the Paris Climate Accord lies ahead next week. Outline for us, if you will, some of the challenges that are facing participants.
Yeah, next week is probably the most important conference since Paris 3 years ago. And the work that has to be done is sort of the nitty-gritty of how Paris will function, how countries will, you know, represent their progress to the international community, whether there will be expert and peer review, or whether essentially countries will put forward information and the world will take them at their word that they're doing whatever they're saying they're doing. Rules about how finance will be projected and supplied. You know, there are dozens, actually, of things to be negotiated in the 2 weeks in Katowice.
There are tensions between the U.S., China, within the European Union. Talk about that and trying to bring everybody together in this enormous project.
Sure. Well, really, despite the fact that you mentioned that Trump has said that the U.S. will withdraw from the Paris Agreement by 2020, you know, in the rooms, developed countries generally have the same priorities, which is generally it's transparency. It's making sure that everybody is doing what they say they're doing, that rules are sort of predictable, and that the agreement applies essentially the same way to traditionally rich countries and historically poor countries like China and India and Saudi Arabia and other countries that have traditionally been treated differently in this process. And the developing countries are actually not, they don't always negotiate on exactly the same place. I mean, China and India have historically argued that they are poor countries, that they deserve to develop, and that they don't have the same capacity to either promise, you know, flat cuts in emissions or to put forward information about exactly what they're doing. They're very resistant to having the international community monitor their emissions or their progress. Whereas smaller developing countries, islands, least developed countries, see climate change as an existential threat and have traditionally pushed for a very ambitious regime that will be protective of them and that will provide them with aid that they say they need, that they do need, in order to protect themselves from the effects of climate change.
So what do we expect from U.S. negotiators at this conference?
Well, the State Department is sending career staff and has since, you know, the last couple of years, and they'll be in the room just sort of negotiating the nitty-gritty, keeping their heads down, trying to act constructively, And arguing for a lot of the same things that they argued for under the last administration, things like a strong transparency regime to make sure that the countries are really doing what they're saying they're doing.
Well, Jean, I've read that the U.S. plans to promote fossil fuels and nuclear energy. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, well, that's the State Department team. I mean, what I just described is the State Department team, the career officials who are going. In addition, the Trump administration is sending political staff from the White House.
Okay.
And what they did last year, which they also did last year, is hold a side event that tends to be very controversial, where they highlight the continued role of traditional energy, fossil fuels, and nuclear as possible solutions to climate change. You know, very efficient technologies, they say, and technologies that really the developing world should also adopt. And last year, Dave Banks, who was the White House energy advisor at the time, held this roundtable, and a bunch of environmentalists showed up and started singing and protesting. So likely something like that will happen again. But it's almost like the U.S. plays a schizophrenic role at these talks, because the career staff are in the rooms behaving very much the same way they've always done, except keeping a much lower profile because the U.S. is going to probably leave the agreement, and then outside, the political staff is making a lot of the same points that you expect to be made, you know, by the Trump administration. Mm.
I also had read that some in the U.S. team have tried to undermine climate financing by questioning the concepts of developed and developing countries.
Well, that's actually a traditional point of contention. The U.S. has always sort of grappled with how its money is spent, how its international finance is spent, and there are all these controversies in this process about who gets to take advantage of it, whether China is now too big, you know, and too wealthy and shouldn't be getting that money, you know, whether some of the oil developing, you know, states that are actually very wealthy should get the same advantages that small islands or LDCs do. But of course, it's also true that the Trump administration has taken any future contributions to the Green Climate Fund off the table. Mm. So the U.S. is not providing the $3 billion that Obama promised. We've only provided one, and we're not going to make any further contributions in the future.
Jean Chamnick, does the incoming Democratic majority in the House of Representatives change the climate change narrative for this country moving forward?
Well, I mean, there's not very much that they can do about forcing, for example, Trump to remain in the Paris Agreement. I mean, Obama joined the agreement as an executive agreement, and Trump can leave. There's a process, and the U.S. will remain in the agreement until 2020. But what they do, I spoke to some international sources, right after the midterm. And they said, well, had it been a good night for the Republicans, the world would have sort of thought, okay, this is where the U.S. is now. You know, Trump will probably be reelected. The U.S. is probably out of the Paris Agreement for the foreseeable future. Because it was such a good night for Democrats, they have a sense that this is a temporary situation and that the U.S. will be back. And, of course, you know, the Democrats can now do a lot of oversight, including on the process that led to the Paris withdrawal or other climate-related, you know, decisions that this administration has made. And they can start showing what a Democratic response to climate change might be if they had the power to enact policy in the future sometime.
President Trump, of course, has repeatedly cast doubt on the science of climate change. And some other world leaders, in particular Brazil, seem to be following suit. Let's talk about President-elect Bolsonaro. Brazil, ironically, has been a leader on climate, winning international recognition. But the country apparently is not going to host a UN conference on climate change next year.
Yes, Bolsonaro might have been the biggest climate story of this last year. Of course, he's a right-wing, cast as a populist, is a populist maybe, and has been called the tropical Trump. You know, he's very Brazil first, very economy first. And it's true that Brazil actually historically has been a very strong actor in the international climate arena, and was poised to host next year's COP, which was an important one because in 2020 countries have to come back to the table with even stronger pledges to Paris. And just this week, Brazil, it's still the former administration, said that they would not host it. Bolsonaro has toyed with the idea of perhaps leaving Paris, but it's actually a harder thing for him to do than Trump.
Because, how so?
Because the Brazilian Congress voted unanimously to join Paris, and he would need to convince his Congress to allow him to withdraw, which is not the case in the United States.
So my next question was with President Trump and the president-elect of Brazil, Bolsonaro, wanting to move away from Paris, are we seeing some major cracks in this accord?
Well, I mean, it's not a great sign that he is where he is. I think that it shows that perhaps Trump isn't totally alone in seeing this agreement as an assault on national sovereignty and the economy. And those are the same talking points that he also uses. But it sort of depends on whether that spreads. I mean, Australia also this year has taken a major step back from its commitments in Paris. So there are a couple of examples of this. But there are also players like the European Union that still see themselves as leaders in this area and are putting forward new long-term targets that they hope will get the momentum flowing again. So it remains to be seen. And the next couple of weeks in Katowice will be a bit of a window into what happens next with Paris and whether it will continue to be important.
So, Jean Chemnick, in the news in recent weeks and months, there have been two new significant scientific reports on climate change. The federal government, the U.S. federal government, Black Friday released its report. One of the big takeaways is that left unchecked, climate change could hit the American economy really hard. What has been the response by the Trump administration?
Well, he said some baffling things about not really believing in the findings of the report, even though it was put forward by his administration. But it actually comes on the heels of two international reports, too. There was an extremely important one in October that looked at the difference between if the world warms 1.5 degrees Celsius versus 2 degrees Celsius. And you, as you noted, the goal of Paris and sort of the working assumption of this whole process was that 2 degrees Celsius was enough to keep the world safe from the worst effects of climate change. And this October report establishes that 2 degrees would actually be catastrophic for many countries and would usher in 4 extra inches of sea level rise compared with keeping it at 1.5 degrees and all kinds of problems with extinctions and human suffering. So it strengthens the argument by small islands and a lot of other actors that really we have to take very drastic measures to contain warming. And then there was also a report just this week about the top 20 economies, developed and developing, the ones who are now meeting as the G20 in Argentina, and how far they are from, you know, what they have to do in order to meet even 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees. And in order to stay at the 2-degree threshold, they have to triple their ambition.
Jean Chemnick, thank you so much for joining us for the first part of Radio Times today. Jean is a reporter for E&E News who covers international climate. She will be at the conference next week in Poland. Up next, we'll talk some more about the 4th National Climate Assessment with Rutgers University climate scientist Robert Kopp. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's off today. Ahead of the climate change conference in Katowice, Poland next week, we are discussing two major reports on climate change, which were released recently, one of which is the 4th National Climate Assessment, co-produced by 13 federal agencies and hundreds of scientists. It lays out the potential financial, environmental, and human costs of climate change in the U.S. Joining us now to help us navigate this is climate scientist Robert Kopp, director of the Rutgers Institute of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences in New Brunswick. And Bob, welcome to Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mary.
So this report, which again is mandated by Congress, was released a week ago. And You know, it contains some dire news about the potential for climate change unless humankind puts the brakes on CO2 emissions. And soon, what is the scientific community saying will likely happen in, say, 20 or 30 years globally and across the U.S.?
Well, the basic message of this report, which is roughly 2,000 pages long when you take Volume 1 from last year and Volume 2 that just came out together, is a message that has come out of every climate report for the last decade and a half, right? Climate change is real. It's caused by humans. It's happening now, and it's having impacts now. And we'll come back to that in a second. But it's not too late to avoid the worst impacts by reducing our greenhouse gas emissions to stabilize the climate. We need to bring net greenhouse gas emissions to zero. And by taking proactive measures to adapt to the climate impacts that we don't manage to avoid by reducing emissions. What the new report adds is roughly 1,600 pages of detail on what those impacts happening now are and what they will be in the future in order to inform decision-making at all levels, from local governments to the federal and global level.
So the California wildfires, let's talk about them. Are we seeing the early effects of climate change?
Yeah, well, one of the findings in the reports is that wildfires are becoming more frequent due to increase in heat and dryness. I was actually at a National Academies meeting yesterday, and one of the topics there are the conditions of fire weather. And so this is a real topic of concern. And you know, I mean, we haven't, in our area, had to deal with the terrible air quality that folks out in the Bay Area had to deal with. But you know, a couple weeks ago, the Bay Area had some of the worst air quality in the world as a result of those fires.
All right, let's go to the Northeast, and in particular, talk about the Jersey and Delaware shorelines and potential for sea level rise. Are we seeing that already, or is that just a given if we don't curb emissions?
Yeah, so globally, since 1900, we've seen about 7 to 8 inches of sea level rise on the Jersey Shore, primarily because of the effects of sinking land in response to the end of the last ice age. It's been closer to 15 inches over that time period. And that's had some pretty significant effects. A NOAA study cited in the report found that between the 1950s and the 2000s, the number of minor tidal flooding days, so things that might flood roads, in Atlantic City increased from about 2 days a year to about 20 days a year.
That's big.
That is big, right? And you know, that right, if you think about that, if it's on course, right, if the roads are, say, a foot above sea level, well, once you hit a foot above sea level, those roads are just going to be permanently flooded. So that's why you see that sort of rapid increase as it takes less and less of a high tide to cause the same amount of flooding.
So Bob Cobb, with an eye toward preservation, what do coastal communities need to think about when it comes to planning for the future?
Well, I mean, the most important thing, and this is sort of a key theme throughout dealing with all these impacts, is to bring climate change onto the agenda, right? So if you're thinking about the 30-year plan for your community, sea level rise would better be a part of that. In some cases, right, on that time scale, you can respond to sea level rise by building protective structures. On other times and places, it may make sense to start thinking about expanding parkland and letting the sea take some areas in the future.
So at the Rutgers Institute of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences, are you hearing from some of these communities who are reaching out and saying, you know, all right, where do I begin?
Yeah, so actually that's a major area that we work in. There are a bunch of activities at Rutgers related to helping communities prepare for the impacts of sea level rise and climate change more generally. So, for instance, Rutgers manages the Jacques Cousteau National Estuarine Research Reserve, which runs a program called Getting to Resilience that helps communities plan. We coordinate something called the New Jersey Climate Adaptation Alliance, a stakeholder network of municipalities and NGOs and businesses that are that are helping develop the knowledge base for that. And we run a graduate program that I direct, the Coastal Climate Risk and Resilience Initiative, that's training sort of the next generation workforce to help communities sort of deal at this interface between science and decision making.
So aside from the flooding we spoke about along the shore, are there any other obvious indicators to people who are wondering, like myself, thinking, oh, gosh, it was so warm through the middle of October. Temperatures in the 80s almost every day. Is that just kind of a weather anomaly, or is that a sign of climate change? You know, we're seeing the leaves turning later. You don't want to be an alarmist, But at the same time, what perhaps should we be aware of if there's anything to be aware of?
Yeah, so one of the findings in the report for the Northeast region is that winters have warmed about 3 times faster than summers. So it's not your imagination that the winters are warmer. The report discusses the fact that we're seeing more early buds. And sometimes, because it's still winter, those early buds are followed by hard frosts.
And I'm so sure that affects agriculture.
That affects agriculture. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the report talks about how that affects fruit crops generally. But yeah, that's a significant impact. Meanwhile, I mean, it's not talked about as much in the report, but there is some work some of my colleagues at Rutgers suggesting that we're also seeing, as a result of the decline in Arctic sea ice, sort of more stagnant weather patterns. So even though on average it's warming, when it gets cold, it may stay cold longer.
Yeah, because we do get these monstrous snowfalls every once in a while,
yeah,
too.
So the snowfalls you actually might expect just because it's still below freezing, and in a warmer atmosphere, you have more water in the atmosphere,
okay.
Right? So a general thing seen throughout the year, actually more so in the summer, is that we're seeing an increase in the intensity of rainfall, which is another major driver of impacts. It's different sort of flooding than we were talking about earlier.
Bob, you say it's not too late to avoid the worst effects of climate change. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, so just think about what we've gone through. We've talked to sea level. We haven't talked about human health, but that's one that's sort of directly related to temperature. So the more...
So why don't we take that detour before we talk about avoiding the worst effects?
Yeah, well, so heat tends to increase the chance of people dying just from a variety of causes, such as cardiovascular disease. It also tends to worsen air quality, so increasing ground level ozones. There's also effect on pollen, so increasing asthma and hay fever. And the report also mentions the effects of changes in rainfall on the spread of ticks. So Lyme disease being another sort of effect. But the effects on human health through heat, that's really one of the biggest impacts of climate change everywhere. And that's affects death rate. It also affects the ability of people to work outside, and so has an effect on the economy that way.
So again, the worst effects of climate change, if emissions do not change, are still to come.
Yes.
You say, you know, we can still do this. We can put the brakes on. Tell us more about where you're coming from.
Right. Sure. So, I mean, all of these effects that are related to temperature become more severe the more warming we've had. Right now, globally, we've had about 1 degree Celsius or about 2 degrees Fahrenheit warming from the pre-industrial. If we're on sort of the business as usual trajectory outlined in the course in the report, that gets you up to about 4 degrees Celsius or closer to 7 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. So it's considerably more than the 2 degrees Fahrenheit we've already experienced. So that'll make all the heat related impacts more severe. Meanwhile, we talked about sea level rise. The more we warm the planet, the greater the possibility of triggering significant instabilities in the Antarctic ice sheet, which might get us, instead of on it from a trajectory leading to, say, 2 feet of sea level rise over the course of the century, might give us onto a trajectory leading to more like 4, 5, 6 feet of sea level rise.
So the time to take action is now.
Yes.
And so, again, climate change can seem like such an overwhelming issue to just, you know, working everyday folks,
right,
you know, on an individual level. Many of us are just trying to, you know, get to work every day, driving our cars perhaps, or taking public transportation, managing busy lives. These issues can take priority. Climate change can just seem like a big story that's over here someplace. What are some things that we can do to actually feel as if we're making a difference and actually are making a difference?
Yeah. Well, so start with, right, ultimately we keep coming back to mitigation and adaptation, right? So reducing greenhouse gas emissions and preparing for the effects of climate change. And by and large, a lot of those decisions are social decisions. So the most important thing we can do is be part of that change, right? Which means, first of all, right, as you said, climate change, we don't think about all the time. It takes a back seat. So the most important thing to do is talk about it in general. About two-thirds
with your friends?
With your friends, with your neighbors. About two-thirds of Americans say they rarely or never hear discussions of climate change. And so the first thing we need to do is get it on sort of the national agenda by talking about it. And related to that, become active citizens. You know, were we talking a couple weeks ago, I would have said vote. There's a lot to do besides voting between elections, making sure your elected officials know that this is of a concern. So that really, that sort of building towards social action is the most important things. There are also things we can do in our individual lives.
Look around the house, look in the car.
Yeah, exactly, right. So there are plenty of tools online to help you do things like measure your carbon footprint on the mitigation side and figure out, well, what are the biggest things you're doing that emit carbon dioxide, right? So flying a lot tends to be sort of the curse of academics. So that, you know, think about how ways of reducing flying.
Take the train?
Take the train instead of driving, if that's possible. Find a way to increase, get a more fuel-efficient car. But there are also simple things that save money pretty quickly. If you have a house, get an energy audit on the house and think about insulating it, right? That a lot of energy use in this country is used for heating and cooling buildings. So there's that sort of, where is my carbon footprint and how do I reduce it?
Is there a good reference that if somebody were interested in researching this more, you know, online or reach out to, does the Institute have anything online that, you know, folks might be able to access?
That's a good idea. We don't. But if you Google carbon footprint or something like that, you'll find a bunch of tools. The other thing which this sort of relates is just to make climate change part of your key decisions, right? Whether those are decisions about things that emit carbon or decisions about investments that might be affected in the long term. So, right, if you're buying a house, ask about the flood risk, right? That's something that, you know, both elevates the flood risk onto the agenda, say for realtors, and is a wise thing for you to be doing, because if you don't ask about the flood risk and it takes you by surprise, it's probably going to cost you money down the road.
You would like to see less housing density in areas that tend to flood, perhaps moving back from areas that naturally flood?
That's probably generally a good idea, but there's also ways, if you're in that area, well, you know, if you elevate your house, that can help. So it's just flood risk is both a regional thing, but it's also an individual property thing, right? This, if you're at ground level versus you're at 6 to 9 feet, you have different flood risks in the same areas. So elevating it onto the adaptation and flood risk onto the agenda that way is one thing. Another thing I did when we recently bought a house is ask about energy usage, right? Get electric and gas bills, because that relates directly to the carbon footprint of the house. Also relates to saving money.
Exactly.
And, you know, oftentimes things like flood risk and energy use aren't really fully priced in to these sort of major investments.
How do you open the conversation with a friend? Because sometimes it's hard to talk about this subject. Not everybody is fully invested. You know, you don't want to necessarily hit somebody over the head with it, because that's not going to win any people to the concept of mitigating climate change.
Yeah. So I think that the person I turn to with those sorts of questions is my friend Catherine Hayhoe down in Texas, who's like probably the best person in the country at doing this. But one of the things she says, right, you don't start the conversation by talking about necessarily here are the facts, right, about climate change. You start by finding shared interests with people, right? And if it's your friends, neighbors, right, that's where you already have things you care about together. And most of those things, or many of those things, are probably going to be affected by climate change. The well-being of our children, right?
Sure.
I have a young child. I hope he's still going to be around in 2100. You know, this is his life we're talking about. You know, you're in a coastal community. You're probably seeing this increase in nuisance flooding, right? That's something that needs to be on the community agenda and not just sort of taken as a given.
All right, let's get to some comments. We've got a Facebook message from Susan, who says, "We need to be alarmists, not ostriches. Thanks for this program." Thanks for the comment to Radio Times, Susan. Neeti says, "Reducing meat consumption is a good way for people to make a difference. You don't have to give it up completely, but eating it one meal a day instead of three times a day or going meatless one day really helps." And Bob, you're nodding your head.
Yep. I mean, that's absolutely, there's been some studies that suggest that it's going completely to a vegetarian diet is sort of like switching from SUV to a Prius.
Well, and also as far as raising cattle, methane is a huge greenhouse gas contributor that we really don't talk about as much as CO2.
You know, I think that's right. It's harder to go after, it's harder to reduce than CO2, because it is a distributed source rather than what we call a point source. But it's a significant fraction of overall emissions. And then, of course, on the carbon budget of the planet, you know, roughly 10% of CO2 emissions come from deforestation, and a major driver of deforestation is the ever-growing need for land to support agriculture.
So do planners need to include forestation trees, not perhaps knocking down as many trees where they're developing communities and other industrial complexes?
Yeah, I mean, that's an important part of the solution. You talked about the 1.5 degree and 2 degrees C Paris goals. Most of the projections of how we get there require the planet to have net negative emissions. I mean, that means we take more CO2 out of the atmosphere than we put into it. And the only way to do that is by accelerating the removal of CO2 from the atmosphere. And the only way we know now does that reliably is through forestation.
We'll be talking about some other ideas in our final segment.
Your next guest, Steve Piccolo from Princeton, is going to be talking about some of the as yet relatively unproven technological ways of assisting this. But you know, we need to go from forests being a net source through deforestation to a net sink of carbon dioxide.
Email from Richard: to what degree are there discussions among climate progressives that political systems, capitalism versus socialism, must change as well as lowering carbon emissions?
Well, I'm coming at this as a climate scientist, not as an activist, but certainly there is, this current you've seen in some of the discussions of a Green New Deal, for instance, that would suggest fairly dramatic changes. And if you are trying to get to this 1.5 degrees C goal, one of the conclusions of the report that basically requires global emissions to hit zero around 2050. And that's certainly a massive change.
So, Bob, what do you think is, and I'm asking for an opinion here and a prognostication as opposed to scientific inquiry. It's, what do you think is going to happen at the end of, I think it's December 14th, when this climate conference in Poland wraps up?
Yeah, well,
do you see a solid framework being structured rules?
I hope so. I mean, one of the things, right, after the Paris Agreement, countries made pledges to lower their emissions. And one of the key parts of that is the process for checking on those pledges and ratcheting them up. And so getting that process going, the process of monitoring how countries are doing and increasing ambition is a key part of making Paris a success.
Bob Kopp, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us here for Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Bob is director of the Institute of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Rutgers University in New Brunswick. And up next, we're going to be talking about negative emissions technologies, which actually could pull carbon out of the air. More straight ahead. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We're catching up to the latest in climate science ahead of a major gathering of countries convening on climate change next week in Poland. And one question that's increasingly being asked is whether it's time to give equal weight to strategies which involve removing carbon from the atmosphere as a way to slow global warming, also known as negative emissions technologies. Stephen Piccolo is professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Princeton University. He chaired the National Academies of Sciences Committee, which wrote the recent report titled Negative Emissions Technologies and Reliable Sequestration. Steve, great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
So technologies which would pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere have traditionally taken a back seat in the climate change debate, in part because the theory was if we focus too much on removing carbon, then efforts to slow the release of greenhouse gases would be stymied. Is that accurate?
I think so. I think it's also fair to point out, though, that reforestation, which is a way, as the previous discussant mentioned, to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and store it on the surface in the bodies of trees. And that's been part of the process since at least the Kyoto Agreement of more than a decade ago.
So, and we'll get to deforestation in a little bit more in just a moment, but as a scientist and as an observer, do you think there is the global will to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to the point where the worst effects of climate change will be averted? And part two of this is then, again, is it time to give equal and serious consideration to carbon removal technologies?
So I'll answer those two questions sequentially. First of all, I think that the progress that humanity has achieved over the last 15 years in the zero-emitting energy technologies is unprecedented and spectacular. Wind and solar are now the cheapest forms of energy in the right places. We have abundant natural gas and know how to do carbon capture and storage. So we have the capacity to build, for the first time as a species, a zero-emitting modern energy economy. And every year those technologies, those alternatives get cheaper. Every year the damages, sadly, get more severe. Every year voting populations get younger and less invested in the past. And so I'm quite optimistic that over the long term, we're going to solve this problem. The only question is how much damage we incur along the way.
Well, and so even as wind and solar are becoming, these technologies are being developed and increasingly being implemented, globally, we're having a hard time weaning off of fossil fuels. And we think of some developing countries. China says, I believe, that it's going to wean itself off of coal, but it's going to be a long time. There are many coal-producing plants or coal-burning plants being built, I think, in some Asian countries. So, again, back to, trying to avert the worst effects of global warming, carbon removal technologies. What part do you see them playing in this effort?
An absolutely vital role. The thing is, you asked earlier, should negative emissions technologies be given sort of equal weight with emissions reductions, positive emissions reductions? Just to be clear, negative emissions technologies take CO2 out of the atmosphere and store it either on the Earth's surface in an ecosystem like in the body of a tree or in the soil of a cropland field, or underneath the ground in a geologic reservoir like the ones that oil and gas came from, as opposed to positive emissions technologies that do the opposite, right? They take carbon from the ground and put it into the atmosphere. So negative emissions technologies will play a vital role, and the most critical role that they will play is in offsetting the very, very difficult to reduce emissions that humanity sort of has to keep going. Some of the agricultural methane, N2O, which is a greenhouse gas from fertilizer use, those two are essential. A good segment of that is essential just to produce the food that we need. Also, aviation is probably going to require a chemical fuel. And to offset those, we're going to need a negative emissions technology. It's also the case, though, that the amount of negative emissions that we're likely to be able to do is a minority of the total amount of work that needs to be done to get to net zero as a species. So they won't be an equal player, in my view, with mitigation.
Well, let's get into some of the specific technologies being explored. Direct air capture. How does this work?
So direct air capture is an industrial process that literally absorbs CO2 either into a solution or onto a surface and then concentrates it and injects it as a fluid into a geologic reservoir underground, like the kind of geologic reservoir that oil and gas have come from.
So what does the structure that does this look like?
Well, there's only one commercial one available right now, and it looks kind of like a washing machine.
And the size of the washing machine?
It's modular. You can stack them up. You can get as many as you want. It's a modular thing. A fan blows air through a device that contacts a surface that absorbs the CO2. That surface keeps accumulating CO2 until it's sort of saturated, and then the device heats the sorbent up and drives the CO2 off, and then it's sent someplace.
Give us a sense of how much CO2 this can capture. 10 cars? That from 10 cars? I mean, a washing machine doesn't sound very big.
Yeah, no, this is a small device. Yeah, a good way to think about it is how big a device would you need to say eliminate the emissions of an entire power plant?
Sure.
And that device would be large. It'd be on the scale of the power plant.
Okay. And Stephen, how might this stored CO2 be used, or do these reservoirs have the potential to become problematic in and of themselves?
Well, anything that you do at the kind of scale that we're talking about here, has the potential and really the inevitable potential for problems and damages. On the other hand, we really know how to do this because as a species, we've done a huge amount of it. Most people don't know this, but in the United States right now, you can get $50 a ton of CO2 from the government to store CO2 in a geologic reservoir. And $35 if you use it to produce extra oil. So they're already paying people to do this, and as in part as a result of that, I think the country is over 60 million tons of this being done this year, which is a big number. I mean, that's a number that's getting material.
So we
kind of know how to do this, right?
Why are we not hearing more about it? Is it an expensive technology?
Yeah, direct air capture is still not technologically ready. It's in its infancy. It hasn't been explored really. And so, as I said, there's only one company that's doing it, but there is a startup ecosystem that is flourishing. And the committee that I chaired is optimistic that although not a certainty, there's a high probability that a significant investment in this area could produce a cost-effective technology within 10 years or so. And by cost-effective, I mean $100 a ton of CO2, which translates into $1 a gallon for gasoline.
Okay. Carbon mineralization is another technology. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so carbon mineralization is the one that is least understood. And if I had to pick a place where we might be really surprised in this business, that's the area that I'd pick. It turns out that some rocks will spontaneously and rapidly absorb CO2 from the atmosphere and turn it into carbonate rocks where it's stable for geologic time. And if you ask how much of this stuff is there underneath our feet, say within a kilometer of the surface so that it would be accessible if we wanted to access it, the answer is it's enormous. It's enough to take all of the CO2 out of the atmosphere, which
really
would be a bad thing, thousands of times. All right. So it's a huge, huge resource that we haven't recognized. And so the question is, could we somehow bring the CO2 to the surface area of those rocks or bring those rocks to the atmosphere and mitigate the problem that way, create a negative emission that way? But it's almost unexplored as a subject.
Well, as the seriousness of the climate change issue grows, are there active efforts to explore carbon mineralization?
Well, there is an effort that is growing, and there is some activity. Some companies are interested, mining companies in particular are interested, because if their tailings piles already contain some of these minerals, then they could reduce their carbon emissions by just raking their tailings piles, that sort of thing. So that there is activity, but there hasn't been the sort of concerted push that the opportunity warrants. So the same thing with direct air capture, right? So both of those areas have received much less attention by the technical community and the research community and by funders than their potential warrants.
Stephen Bacala, maybe perhaps some technologies that could be put into place right now. How about changing agricultural practices? Perhaps this could encourage the storage of carbon in the soil. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is one that is ready. So that there are four different ways of creating negative emissions that are technologically ready. And this is the one that is the clearest win-win. So it turns out that when you plow up soils and otherwise do modern agriculture on them, metabolize, you release to the atmosphere a lot of the carbon backbone of those soils. And the carbon backbone of those soils keeps the soils fertile, adds to their water retention, which is good for the crops, and it adds to nitrogen retention, which reduces the need for fertilizer. And so by restoring the carbon backbone in those soils, by taking the CO2 from the atmosphere and getting it into those soils, you both increase agricultural efficiency and productivity, increase the stability of farm economies, decrease the fluctuations in yields, and you store carbon in those lands, take it out of the atmosphere.
And how much are we talking about potentially pulling from the atmosphere or preventing from entering the atmosphere here?
Yeah, the numbers are material, but not transformative. So think about the humanity as releasing 50 units in terms in the units for people who are interested are billions of metric tons of what are known as CO2 equivalents. But 50 of those units is what humanity does globally. This might allow you to do one or two or three of them, something like that.
But every little bit helps.
Every bit helps, and especially if it's a win-win, why not do it?
Steve Fakala, we've got some emails and questions coming in. Is composting a form of carbon sequestration?
Yes. Anything that causes organic matter to pile up on the surface rather than be decomposed and go to the atmosphere means that there's been a transfer from the atmosphere to the land surface. The gaining of carbon weight by anything on the surface comes typically from the atmosphere.
And this might be getting off topic a bit, but Andy asks, why isn't nuclear power generation considered zero power emission? Or is it?
Well, it is, right? I mean, it is. Nuclear power doesn't generate CO2 emissions.
So is the disinclination to develop nuclear power, is it the issue in storing the byproducts of nuclear power energy?
No, there are two main issues with nuclear power. One issue is because of the safety concerns largely, and because we haven't invested as a species in modernizing reactor designs, nuclear power is expensive. All right. It's way more expensive than wind or solar or natural gas with carbon capture and storage even. And so it's just simply expensive. And one of the reasons it's expensive is that people are afraid of it.
Yeah. A couple more other negative emissions technologies. Bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. We're running a little short of time, but in brief, what is that? How does that work?
So plants eat CO2 for a living and turn it into plants, which is a negative emission. And if you then take those plants and burn them and heat up water and make electricity from that, that would return the CO2 to the atmosphere, and that'd just be using biofuels and it would be zero.
Yeah.
However, if you catch the CO2 as it's going up the smokestack of the power plant and then inject it back into a geologic reservoir, you get the electricity out but still have the negative emission.
And that does not sound like an expensive technology.
It's sort of intermediate. You can think of it as 50 or 60 or 70 cents a gallon if it were gasoline, right? That's added to the cost of gasoline to offset the CO2 that would be created by burning a gallon of gasoline.
So, Stephen Pakala, let's take a look in the crystal ball. Over the next 10 years, where do you see negative emission technologies in the overall effort to curb climate change? 20%, 30% as these technologies receive increasing interest?
Yeah, so I think that if we look at the options that are available today, the forestry options and the agricultural options, we're talking about something that could be effectively scaled up in the near term to handle sort of 10% or so of emissions. But I also think that a concerted research effort by both industry, startup industries in particular, and academics and federal labs and that sort of thing, could create a whole new set of options through direct air capture and maybe carbon mineralization. And the potential is potentially very large, right? So we really don't know how big it could be, but it could really be material and massively improve our prospects for limiting climate change.
Nice to end the show on a note of hope. Thank you, Stephen Pakala.
Thank you.
A pleasure to have you with us. Stephen Pakala is professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Princeton University. He chaired the National Academies of Sciences Committee, which wrote the recent report titled Negative Emissions Technologies and Reliable Sequestration. As always, we invite you to follow us at Radio Times on social media, and we've got a whole library of podcasts as well. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, Elder John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.